Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. We're going to get started in a minute. Just going to let the room fill out. Hope you guys are enjoying some smooth lo-fi jazz tunes, getting ready for the having. Welcome everybody joining us. We're excited for this conversation today. We got a full house already. I love it. Think it's time we get into it. Welcome everyone, and thank you for joining us for today's webinar. Meet the Halving: Is Bitcoin Designed to Pump Forever? I'm Tony, your host and community manager here at Casa. We're just days away from one of the most anticipated events in the Bitcoin cycle, the Halving. Every 4 years, the Bitcoin protocol automatically cuts block rewards received by miners in half. This small code change has profound implications for Bitcoin's economic and market dynamics. To explain this phenomenal event, we have legendary cypherpunk and Casa's chief security officer, Jameson Lopp, joining us today. But before I hand it over, a quick disclaimer. Please note the following content is provided for entertainment purposes only and is not intended as financial, legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Casa urges you to consult a qualified professional for any such advice or service. Here's how today's webinar will flow. First, I'll introduce Jameson, who will then present for around 40 minutes, covering the technical details of the halving process, expected impacts, historical context, and analysis for the upcoming event. After that, we'll open it up for a 20-minute Q&A session, where Jameson will take questions from all of you on the halving and its broader effects. With that out the way, let me briefly introduce our special guests. We're excited to have Casa co-founder and chief security officer Jameson Lopp joining us. As a technologist, his mission is to make cryptographic protocols accessible, empower individuals to take self-custody and manage their Bitcoin securely. For more than a decade, he has curated a go-to hub for Bitcoin resources at bitcoin.page and researched many facets of the Bitcoin protocol and its origins. His work is pivotal in adjusting the balance of power between authorities and individuals globally. We're thrilled to have Jameson lay out the technical details and economic forces at play with the upcoming halving event. Jameson, the floor is yours.
All right. Let's see if we can get some screen sharing action on here. So that we can begin. All right. Looks good. So, yeah, here we are. Yet another halving. This is, you know, a once every 4 years event, and it seems like it always spurs a great debate every time. People are never sure, is it going to be different this time, or will we see a continuation of what we have experienced the past few times? So, what is the halving? I'll jump in here and just assume that people don't know anything. But you probably at least know that Bitcoin is meant to ultimately be a deflationary asset. And that basically means that the rate of inflation, the rate of newly created Bitcoin, is going to go down over time. So far, so good. This is built into the protocol. And what we're approaching right now is one of those trigger points at which the protocol will change some of the consensus and validation rules to basically say that the maximum amount of allowed newly created Bitcoin that a miner is allowed to claim in a new block and the Coinbase output is going to get cut in half. And so what you can see here is this chart of the inflation rate in the red, really annual inflation rate. As you can see, the first 4 years, the first mining epoch had a really high inflation rate that finally came down to about 30% by 2012. And then we've been hitting these step functions and sort of asymptotically approaching zero for each new mining era. And so, of course, in the blue, you then see the total amount of Bitcoin that exists, because that's it's really just an aggregate of all of the inflation rates over the years. So, what is actually happening here? Basically, the miners, they are going to have to deal with this economic shock. And of course, it's not a surprise. We've known that this is going to happen ever since the very first Bitcoin block, because it is encoded into the protocol. And as a result, some miners will likely become unprofitable. Basically, the miners that have been operating closest to the edge of profitability are most likely to get knocked out of the game, so to speak. Those miners who are operating at perhaps an industrial scale, or operating in a unique situation where they have a unique competitive advantage and have extremely low electricity rates or other operational costs that can undercut less efficient miners on the network, they're going to keep going. And so, well, what should we expect to happen with the mining hash rate? Well, some of these miners are going to leave, but I can tell you, I was actually at a conference last weekend and spoke to some people from large mining farms, and they're actually continuing to add hash power. And that's kind of the name of the game. They've been working on this for a long time. It's a long-term play. They knew what was going to happen, and they have already put themselves in a position where they expect to be profitable even after the block reward gets cut in half. So, what's going to happen at the actual date of the halving, which is just a few days away? As a result of this, we should expect probably a slight decrease in hash rate overall, but like I said, some miners out there are going to be increasing hash rate regardless. So, overall, it's going to balance out, but whatever does happen after this late Friday, early Saturday halving, depending on what time zone you're in, it really only lasts probably about a week in terms of the blocks being either slower or faster, because the halving is actually about in the middle of a difficulty adjustment. So we go another week, and based on whether the blocks are coming in slower or faster, the network difficulty will adjust accordingly, and we should get back to approximately 10-minute block times. Now, one of the long-term questions that comes up basically with every halving is the question of what's going to happen several halvings or 10 halvings down the line when there's basically no more Bitcoin that's going to be mined. And this is the perennial question. We know the subsidy, the newly created coins, is going to keep going down. However, the offset to this is the fact that miners get to collect transaction fees. And while some people say this won't be an issue for another 100 years, I think it'll probably, or at least potentially, start to become an issue in 10 or 20 years, because we will be really, really close to zero new coins after a few more halvings. I think after this one, we will be going from 6 to 3.125, I think 6.25 to 3.125 Bitcoin mined with each block. So just a few more, and we'll be well under one Bitcoin mined per block. So once we get to the point where there's no more coins being mined, that's when you'll really be able to say that Bitcoin is deflationary. Right now, Bitcoin is still inflationary, but it's predictably inflationary. So why do miners even put up with this? Why do they allow their salary to essentially get cut in half? Well, they don't have much choice, and this is part of the name of the game of this balance of power amongst different players on the network. The miners, they do have some power in a sense. The miners are essentially the entities that are securing the network. They are pushing the blockchain forward by mining new blocks. But there's counterbalance to that. One of the other major constituent groups in Bitcoin are the node operators. And those node operators always have the power to reject blocks that they don't like for whatever reason. So it's possible, and in fact, it has been done before at the first halving in 2012, that miners may decide that they want to mine a block that continues giving themselves the higher amount of Bitcoin. A few miners did this in 2012. They said, we want to keep getting 50 Bitcoin per block. We don't want to cut it down to 25. And so they modified the code on their nodes that they used to generate the block templates. And they mined some blocks. And what did they find out? Well, fairly predictably, they ended up off on a fork that was no longer Bitcoin because all of the nodes on the network rejected their blocks. So they were essentially mining these blocks that had no value because they couldn't take those Coinbase outputs, those newly mined quote unquote Bitcoin, and actually send them to anyone else on the network. Much less like send them to an exchange or pay bills with them, so on and so forth. So essentially, they were wasting their electricity, and they figured out pretty quickly that the rational thing for them to do was to go back to actually following the Bitcoin protocol along with everyone else and mine the block subsidy that got cut in half so that they would actually receive something of value for their hard work. Haven't heard of anybody else even attempting to try to do that again. Lesson learned. So where are we on this 100-year-long timeline? Here, we have the step function. Basically, what I've done is on the left-hand side, this is the actual annual inflation rate that we have seen as a result of the rate of blocks being produced over the years. As you can see, it's a little bit volatile. Mining is a somewhat random process, and also there's some other variables in there that cause miners to create blocks faster or slower than every 10 minutes, and so that's what results in a little bit of volatility, though on the long-term time frame, it pretty much evens out, and as you can see, it pretty closely mirrors the expected inflation rate. And so, as you can see, we're here approaching one, two, three, four, the fourth halving. And we definitely will expect that we'll be getting down to that sub 1%, right around 1% inflation rate after this halving. So far, so good. And this halving, we say it's every 4 years, but technically, it's every 210,000 blocks, which, because a block happens approximately every 10 minutes, means that it's approximately every 4 years that we're running into this. Now, historically, it's always been somewhat less than 4 years, and that's because of improvements in the hardware that we're actually using to mine. So, one interesting phenomenon with the mining hash rate is that hash rate doesn't merely increase over time. If you've ever looked at a chart of hash rate, this log chart is a little bit deceptive because it is log scale, so it's going up in orders of magnitude. If you look at it on a linear chart, it's really a hockey stick, just up and to the right and up, up, up. And that's because hash rate historically is not just increasing, it's actually accelerating. Every year over year, we add more hash rate at an even faster pace than the year before. And this is a combination of both improvements in the hardware and, of course, the fact that over long-term time frames, the exchange rate goes up. And I will definitively state, because this is always another somewhat controversial thing, but my perspective is that hash rate follows price. Price does not follow hash rate. Basically, the amount of hash rate on the network is a function of what the total value is that the network in aggregate is paying to the miners. Sometimes I think people get confused about this relationship because it's not a real-time relationship. There are extreme amounts of lag, in the months to, if not year-long lag time in the relationship between the Bitcoin exchange rate and the hash rate. And that is once again due to sort of the industrial scale at which a lot of the mining is going on right now, where we're seeing tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars put into investing in mining infrastructure. And this is all being done on year-long, if not multi-year-long time frames. So when people are investing hundreds of millions of dollars into a mining business, they're not going to suddenly change their mind because the Bitcoin exchange rate crashed for a few months or a year or whatever. They're already aware of these very long market cycles that are happening. They're already aware of the relationship and variables at play with regard to all of their capital expenditure costs, their operational expenditure costs, and generally hedging against as much of the volatility as possible. So while we're not seeing quite the same rate of acceleration that we did in previous mining epochs, because we were seeing orders of magnitude improvements in the efficiency, where for the first 2 years, you could only really mine with the CPU on your computer. And then once people figured out how to use graphics cards, those were hundreds, if not thousands of times faster and more efficient than the CPUs. And then, within a few years after the sort of graphics card era, we hit the ASIC era, the application specific integrated circuit. And this is where people basically started fabricating their own custom silicon in order to create these mining machines that we see today. And it started off at really high, cheap processes in the like 100 something nanometer range. And this chart is a few years out of date, but basically where we are right now with the state of mining hardware is essentially on par with top of the line silicon fabrication technology, where I think we're seeing chips in the 5 nanometer, if not smaller range now. So we should expect as a result of that since we've essentially hit the threshold of silicon fabrication technology, that at this point, the acceleration in hash rate is only really going to be driven by exchange rate increases and by other means of finding lower power costs around the world. We're not going to really see much more acceleration as a result of hardware improvements unless the world in general somehow comes up with something that essentially breaks Moore's law and pushes this to some new, completely new type of computing technology. And sort of related to that, I've got a number of charts from previous research where I was looking at some of the phenomenon of blocks and different eras. So once again, this is that GPU era where we were seeing insane level of relative hash rate increase. And on the y-axis here, we have the sort of total number of blocks within this period of block 85,000 to 130,000. The red curve is the expected count of blocks that took that many seconds to mine after the last block. So, the 600 second mark over about 3/4 of the way on the right side of the screen, that's the 10-minute mark where we would expect everything to be kind of clustered around that. And in general, that the counts would follow that red line. But as you can see, the block counts that are at the like 100 to 200 second mark, like blocks coming in faster than every 2 minutes, that count was really, really high during that period of time. And that's because people were adding these relatively fast mining graphics cards that were just causing the Bitcoin network to constantly have to trigger the difficulty to make it slower, to basically make it more difficult and slow down the blocks because they were coming in way too fast. So That's quick history, but what can we learn from that? Where are we going? How sure are we that Bitcoin isn't going to completely blow up at the halving? And I was actually there for the first halving, and it was a little bit tenuous because we had never been through it before. And I really remember when it happened, I was like, okay, it happened, and nothing happened really, other than the subsidy, of course, getting cut in half. At that time, we didn't see like a massive jump in the exchange rate. We didn't see really any other network activity that was worth talking about. It was a pretty quiet first halving, and that was, I think, a good thing. You want these quote unquote major changes to go off without a hitch. So looking forward, I think we can be pretty confident that this halving algorithm is going to work for quite a while. And how do we know that? Well, the Bitcoin test network is actually due to a multitude of eccentricities and edge cases and special rules currently operating at block 2.5 something million, which, if testnet blocks only came in every 10 minutes, that would be equivalent to operating somewhere in the year 2057. So, testnet is basically the exact same as the main Bitcoin network, except for a few rules around the mining difficulty that have led it to be where it is today at this really high block height that would be equivalent to being decades in the future. So, we know that it works for at least, what is that, 30 more years? Now, there's a Bitcoin improvement proposal, number 42, that is actually 10 years old now. And BIP42 was an adjustment to the block subsidy logic. What happened back then, this anonymous developer called Ditto B, who we've never heard from before or since, basically opened an issue on the Bitcoin code repository. And they said, hey, there's an issue with the halving logic. It's an edge case, an overflow problem that won't happen until far in the future. But just for a little nerding out here, in the purple code I put in the bottom right, it was two lines of code. And it's very compact, very dense. And even if you're a developer, it's probably a little hard to read if you're not familiar with bit shift operators. This is not something that you see a lot in normal software development, at least in web software development. And essentially, what was the block subsidy logic saying? It was saying, okay, we're going to start off and it's going to be 50 Bitcoin for every block. And then, every 210,000 blocks that come through, we take the number of halvings that have happened by basically taking the block height, dividing it by that 210,000 block limit. And for each one of those halvings, we're going to shift this subsidy number to the right. We're gonna bit shift it. And what does that do? Well, it's just a fancy way of saying we're going to cut it in half due to the way that binary numbers are represented. And that actually works quite well until you've done it for so many times that you run out of room in which you can shift the bit over to the right again. And so there's this eccentricity to doing this operation in C++, which there's an overflow problem. So basically, I think once we got down to something like 64 halvings, hundreds of years in the future, we would hit a problem where that bit would shift from being to the most right, which would essentially be equivalent to block subsidy of one Satoshi, if not probably actually far less than one Satoshi. But it would shift over to the right and it would turn into what I believe would be the equivalent of 92 billion Bitcoin. So basically, a few hundred, well, 100 years from now, we would go all the way down to zero Bitcoin. We would then go for another 100 years with zero Bitcoin, but all of a sudden, about 200 something years in the future, we would restart. But not only would we restart, we would start creating like 92 billion Bitcoin with every new block. And of course, that is not desirable. So what happened? Well, it was basically like an additional two lines of code that BIP42 enables, which just checks for an overflow. And it says, you know, if we've already done 64 halvings or whatever, then stop doing the bit shifting. So that was a simultaneously major change to the protocol. It was, you know, a consensus change, and yet it was also probably the least controversial consensus change of all time. And in fact, there was basically no debate around it. There was not even any sort of signaling or flagging or anything. It just went into the next release of the Bitcoin client. And so far, so good, because, you know, that extra two lines of code isn't even going to get executed for several centuries. So, where does this put us on the economics side of things? Well, as I mentioned, you know, we can look at previous halvings and we can see that, yes, the hash rate probably will go down, but that's going to be temporary. That's going to be some small subset of inefficient miners that are currently teetering on the brink of profitability, and they get pushed into unprofitability, turn off their miners. But even then, most of that hardware is unlikely to simply get thrown in the trash. Those unprofitable miners are going to do the most rational economic thing, and they're going to sell that hardware, probably pretty cheaply, and that hardware is going to get shipped somewhere. Somewhere likely with much lower electricity costs, get plugged back in and keep going. So I do expect we'll see something similar here, where it's like a temporary short drop in the hash rate, and then we just continue chugging forward. And this is actually related to that issue of, well, what happens as the block subsidy goes to zero and, you know, miners aren't getting paid anymore. You know, another way of looking at this is, you know, don't just look at what is the amount of Bitcoin that the miners are receiving, but if you look at the combination of the issuance, the new Bitcoin plus the fees that they're collecting, and especially if you look at it in terms of, you know, fiat or some other somewhat more stable form of value, then we can see that actually this bootstrapping seems to be working quite well, where even though they're getting less Bitcoin in each mining epoch, they're actually getting a lot more value and, of course, able to reinvest that value into their businesses. So I'm not going to be worried about the block subsidy getting cut in half with regard to, you know, long-term incentives and being able to pay for this thermodynamic security of the network. I'm not even going to really start worrying about that until we go for like an entire 4-year period and the Bitcoin exchange rate doesn't even double in value. Because as long as it's doubling in value, that will offset, you know, the subsidy getting cut in half. And of course, we're also seeing those fees start to increase as well. They're still somewhat negligible, generally like less than 10% of the block subsidy. Though, you know, after this halving, I think they're probably going to be more like 30 to 50%. And we've already seen for some short periods of time when the fee revenue actually exceeded the block subsidy. So I think that's going to just start happening more and more frequently. And that, you know, if the trends and the patterns continue, then we're going to see the total revenue of these miners, you know, continue to increase and offset that change. So, what's going to happen with the price? Well, history may repeat itself. I'm optimistic that history will repeat itself. Generally, it takes 6 months or so, or at least a few months after a halving, for us to see an exchange rate increase. And this is one thing that is different. And I've seen some traders and speculators and on-chain analysts and whatever, saying that we may be in a new era that is kind of shifting the normal cycle forward, shifting it to the left on the time frame, because this is the first time that Bitcoin has ever hit an all-time high before the halving. And maybe this is due to the ETF, institutional and nation-state adoption. There's a lot of reasons to speculate as to why that is the case, but I think the short version is, Bitcoin is still growing, adoption is still increasing. And so this ought to continue the so-called virtuous cycle. We're cutting the rewards in half. That continues to push us towards a deflationary monetary supply. And some people say that because the amount of newly issued Bitcoin that is entering into existence is getting cut in half, that means there's less being sold by miners. I don't think that that is the case, at least not anymore. And that's for several reasons. First reason is that the amount of Bitcoin that's being created in any given day, it just pales in comparison to the volume of Bitcoin that are being traded on exchanges. So I think it's kind of a drop in the bucket at this point. What I do think that is happening, and the reason why the cycle is probably going to continue, is really around narratives and memetics. It's that every time there is a halving, we have even more confidence that Bitcoin, from an incentive structure, from an economic design, is continuing to work as expected. And this is creating kind of fuel for another hype cycle, just brings more attention to the space, gets more people interested in it. And as each mining epoch goes by, we have more and more years of history where people can kind of point to it and say, look, it's working, it's solid. This is not a high-risk speculative vehicle. This is actually one of the lowest risk, least speculative assets in all time, at least in the way that it has certain assurances around its properties. And so that, I think, is what we're going to see happen this time as well, and we'll have the additional benefit of at least some of these huge ETF issuers and brokers and so on, and possibly even registered investment advisors now going around and actually using this narrative to help pitch Bitcoin as a sound monetary asset to an entirely new class of people. Is it going to go up because of the stock-to-flow model? That I really don't know. It's really hard to say with any of these models that try to predict Bitcoin's price. Is it just happening to look to us, to our monkey brains, to be a good fit? Is it really causation, or is it just correlation due to some unknown set of other factors? So I don't put really too much stock in almost any model. Models are really meant to be broken, but I think that just thinking about this in terms of narratives, memetics, and overall time in the market, that and that longevity continuing to fuel the credibility of the network, bring more people in, and especially with each cycle, bring more people with higher credibility in. So, now we're seeing the fund managers of trillions of dollars of assets basically hyping up Bitcoin because they understand it. We're seeing heads of small nation states hyping up Bitcoin to their peers at other nation states. So that's all kind of a part of the virtuous cycle of adoption as long as Bitcoin continues operating as expected. So hopefully this means that cutting Bitcoin subsidy in half does continue to make us all wealthier, but I think that there's a lot more to it than just that one simple act. It's the fact that we see this happening and we've known that it's going to happen, but as we see it continue to play out as expected, it's just the the predictability of the network and its credibility continue to rise as a result of that. So here we are. We are a little over 2 days away from it. I've been pushing hard trying to get that 420 meme out. I think if we're lucky, it'll be April 20th in Europe when the halving happens. But at this point, it looks like America is unlikely to get that mimetic narrative. But I think as long as some part of the world is there, then we can go for it. Now, we seem to be a little bit further away from the 69,000 mark, so that's going to be a little bit tougher to hit. But I'm sure if we all band together, we can get there. So I think we should be good to go now. Yeah, about 40 minutes for some Q&A.
Thank you, Jameson. That was very insightful. Yeah, really huge thank you. That was a lot of invaluable knowledge and great perspective. I don't know if anybody has questions. I see that hands are raised. You can also use the Q&A feature to facilitate questions. That might be a bit easier. But we can field a few questions. I see Adam has his hand raised. I'm going to press allow to talk. Adam, if you have a question about the happening to Jameson, the floor is yours. Adam, if you can unmute and ask your question. It might be easier to facilitate questions through the Q&A feature if you guys want to type your question. That also works.
And you mentioned halvening, which, if I recall correctly, the halvening term actually originated from Dogecoin. And for whatever reason, it got kind of co-opted and used by really every other crypto network that has a similar supply schedule. So I don't think halvening was a term before like 2016, 2017. It was always halving.
Having that was just a mispronunciation on my end. But Adam, did you have a question? Are you able to unmute? Because we're starting to get answers questions in the Q&A function. I don't know if Adam's going to be able to ask their question. But we can move on to the next person. I see Brandon. Brandon, I'm going to allow you to talk because you're one of the first people to come up. Brandon, do you have a question for Jameson?
Yes, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yep.
Awesome. But Jameson, thank you for the info. I just have a question, I guess, about the general concept of the halving. And I'm not a software guy, but I understand the bit shift and how that works, and it's a division by two. But it translates to like this very unique concept of the supply issuance, like in your first slide, where a lot of Bitcoin are issued up front, and then there's like a very long tail end. Are there any other reasons that you can think of that we would want that concept besides just, oh, it comes from a bit shift? Or I guess, is there any precedent in like computer science or any other field where this kind of concept was put into use?
So I believe, I forget if it was an email or a forum post, but Satoshi was essentially trying to model this off of gold mining or precious metals mining, really any sort of mining in general, like real physical mining. And this is kind of the way that you can actually see output from miners, over long historical time scales, because what happens is they start off mining the stuff really close to the surface. It's very easy. In many cases, like with gold, they might be just literally going around and picking it up out of rivers and really topsoil. But once you exhaust that really easily capturable and refinable ore, then you have to start digging. And really, the deeper you go, the harder it becomes. And generally, the output becomes less unless you start investing more and more into your infrastructure and improving your efficiency and so on and so forth. And so I think that was kind of the primary impetus around why Satoshi started off this way. It was that with really in trying to incentivize bootstrapping the network, because you have to remember that in those first few years, Bitcoin had no value. So you're essentially giving away a lot of nothing in trying to incentivize people to get into it, kind of under the hope that maybe someday it would be worth something and that they would be greatly rewarded. But of course, there was no guarantee of that. And it seems to have worked out. By the first halving, Bitcoin had an actual value. I think the exchange rate at the first halving was somewhere in the like $20 to $50 range. So it had already gotten up to a reasonable amount. And here we are several halvings later, and it's just orders of magnitude greater. There is a lot of discussion that could be had around, well, isn't this having a kind of abrupt supply shock? Like, wouldn't it be better or more optimal if we had a nice smooth function? And you can certainly make some arguments about that, but I would suspect that once again, like the reason that Satoshi chose this particular emission schedule is because of how simple the algorithm was. Literally 2 lines of code. If you wanted a smoother issuance, then it would require more complex algorithm for creating and then verifying it. So that's what we're stuck with. This is a great experiment that seems to have hit on a lot of parameters that worked out well, but there's a ton of other networks out there that have different issuance schedules. Or a lot of them that just started off with huge pre-mines or insta-mines and then kind of eked out small amounts of newly created coins over a long period of time. It's a lot of
Thank you.
speculation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brandon. That was a great question. Appreciate you coming up and asking Jameson. So we got some questions in the chat. I'm gonna ask this one last. That's a good one because it kind of takes us a bit off topic. But someone asked Neil Roseman, if you had to guess, and I know it's a guess, what do you think the hash rate will be exactly 4 years from today? And what do you think the average fees per block would be 4 years from now?
Oh boy, I don't have the chart right in front of me, but I would bet it's at least 10 times higher. Where are we? Like five? I think we're hovering around 600 exahash. So yeah, I mean, I would guess probably at least in the 5,000 exahash range. Of course, that's a completely new prefix. I don't even know what's next after exahash off the top of my head. Now fees, yeah, fees, that's tough because there's a lot more going on. My hope is that several years from now we see more of the layer two technologies and networks that are being proposed and developed right now, and we see those in much higher usage. So that creates a interesting dynamic where it should decrease the total need for block demand or demand for block space. But if you think of the main Bitcoin blockchain as a sort of cryptographic accumulator for a lot of off-chain activity, then there's a lot of give and take there. And basically, high fees on the main chain are going to price out activities on that main chain. And the real question is how many of those activities will be able to get pushed to a second layer Bitcoin network, or are those people going to just completely leave Bitcoin for some other network that's not related to Bitcoin? That's the much harder thing to answer. So at the very least, directionally, I would say fees are going to be a lot higher. And if fees don't keep getting higher, then we have to start worrying, because maybe, you know, we are losing competitively to other networks and protocols because our scaling efforts are not doing as well.
Neil, I hope that answered your question. Appreciate you asking. We got another question. Oh, multiple people are asking, will the recording be posted? Yes, the recording will be posted. So don't worry if you showed up late or if you know someone else that registered and was not able to attend, we will definitely have that available for you. This is a question. What would happen if the 50 Bitcoin in the Genesis block was ever moved? Would it affect the network? Some of these questions aren't directed to the halving, but I still want to hear your input.
Well, technically, the 50 Bitcoin in the Genesis block cannot be spent. And this is due to another weird quirk, possibly an oversight from Satoshi. More likely, Satoshi didn't really care. I have a lot of research and things that I've written about Satoshi that basically led me to the conclusion that they had no intention or interest in spending the Bitcoin that they mined for their own personal gain. So getting back to the actual question, the Genesis block is like hard coded into the Bitcoin client software. And generally what happens is you start up your node, it connects to other nodes, it starts downloading blocks and the transactions. And as it's doing that, it is creating and updating its view of the UTXO set, the unspent transaction outputs, also known as like the Bitcoins that are spendable. And for whatever reason, like I said, probably Satoshi just didn't care, didn't think about it. There is no logic in any of the Bitcoin node software that actually constructs and stores unspent transaction outputs for the Coinbase transaction in the Genesis block. As such, even if Satoshi came back and constructed and signed a transaction to spend, you know, those Genesis block outputs, the transaction outputs don't actually exist in the databases of any of the nodes on the network. And so they would end up rejecting that transaction and saying it's invalid, because it would hit the rule where it checks to see if the transaction outputs exist and are spendable. And each node would say, oh, they don't exist. So even though the transaction is valid, it would get rejected. But that's another of those weird eccentricities of the protocol.
Thank you for that question, anonymous attendee. I hope you got your answer from Jameson. Appreciate you. This question is from Josh. Jameson, thinking of the future of Bitcoin, do you see individual custody becoming a legacy, quirky, and uncommon future? In other words, does the advancement of the network have centralization risk if hyper-Bitcoinization theory is realized? Thanks, Josh.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely risks. This is one of the bigger issues that I'm worried about these days, is what happens if Bitcoin goes mainstream faster than we are able to scale the ability for people to do self-custody. And especially with the fact that, you know, ETFs and, you know, traditional financial vehicles tend to be a lot more user-friendly than going through the whole process of setting up your exchange account, setting up your self-custody, withdrawing to that self-custody, managing keys, so on and so forth. This is, you know, a tendency for humans to prioritize convenience over all else. So I do expect that in terms of like total number of people, if we continue on the path that we're on right now, a sort of mainstream hyper Bitcoinized world would mean that most people probably just have Bitcoin IOUs in some in one of the huge centralized custodians. This is where I think there's a lot of debate to be had around scaling the network and what does that mean. There are many different variables at play, trade-offs, things that we prioritize, and reasons why scaling Bitcoin is difficult because there are a lot of, valuable aspects to the network that we don't want to compromise. So, one potential dystopian future, which would be great, I think, for anyone who is already here and already holding Bitcoin, but not so great for the rest of the world, is one in which it's just so expensive to do anything on the main chain that only the earliest adopters and essentially the biggest whales who have the most Bitcoin are able to afford doing that. There's a lot of different paths that we could go down here, and we're starting to see some early experiments in other sorts of custodianship arrangements, especially when we're starting to talk about second layer networks. And this is where things get interesting, also more complicated to talk about of if it is determined that it is not a priority that Bitcoin is able to get, a UTXO into most people's hands for self-custody, then what are the next best things? What are the security models that we can make available via, second layer networks or some sort of UTXO sharing protocols or virtual UTXOs are starting to be thrown around. Like I said, there's many different paths that this can go down, and they all have different trade-offs. So the most important thing is for us to just keep discussing, keep developing. I once again, one of the things that I'm more worried about is just people stopping to work on this. There's still so much work to be done. I can tell you right now, like if we stop working on improving Bitcoin, then that dystopian future where very few people actually have self-custody, have the strongest available security model to them where they can really be sovereign unto themselves, that's just not going to be feasible for more than the smallest percentage of elite early adopters.
Appreciate that question, Josh. I hope the answer from Jameson was sufficient. We have another question. This one's a little funny. Can we send miners to space on a satellite, and how delayed, disadvantaged would they be from that distance? Like, we're sending it to the moon.
I think you could do low Earth orbit without any problem. As long as you're in the milliseconds, like sub second range, it's not too much of a problem. Once your latency to be able to transmit at least the 80 byte block header to the main network and get it propagated around, like once you start getting into several seconds or beyond, that's when you start having real orphan risk of people or other miners finding a block after you, but being able to propagate it to the network before you, causing you to lose out on your money. So, until we achieve some sort of faster than light communication, it really is going to be all about how many light seconds away are you from the main network on Earth.
Hope your question got answered, anonymous attendee. And we have a lot of questions, y'all. I see people who are trying to say, make sure you ask my question, but if you're anonymous, it's hard to follow who asked what and what question to follow up on. But another question from, oh, that one is, they're trolling.
See, someone
What?
asked about observing the halving in real time. There's actually like a dozen
Yeah.
websites to do that. Mempool.space has a little halving adjustment clock on the main page. Bitcoinblockhalf.com is another a good one that's really more dedicated to that. But you'll notice that none of them are really in consensus with each other, and this is because there are many variables at play, and different halving countdowns make different assumptions. And so, we are only a few days away now, so the main thing, you can generally calculate it yourself because you can see like how many blocks are we away. And then the main question is, how quickly do you assume the blocks come in? And I would look at like how quickly they've been coming in over the past week since the last difficulty adjustment. And I can actually check right now on mempool.space. We can see that blocks have been coming in every 9.8 minutes. So, would you basically multiply total number of blocks left, 321 right now, by 9.8 minutes to get a slightly more accurate estimate. But like we said, hash rate is unpredictable. It's very difficult to know what the true hash rate is at any given time, and it can always change, and there's luck involved. So miners could have a streak of good luck or bad luck, and that can greatly affect the perceived hash rate at a global level for a short period of time.
Thank you for that response, Jameson. Someone asked about any thoughts on the power law vis-a-vis stock to flow seen popping up on X. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, like I think all models look great until they get broken. So I don't really ascribe to any model, especially anyone who's out there who's like pitching their model as being great. They're probably just trying to market themselves and get more attention. The likelihood of any of really anyone having a great predictive model, I think, is pretty low.
Appreciate that answer. We had one question about using layer twos. Why would you use a layer two and not just go to Bitcoin?
So layer twos have pros and cons. A second layer network is, I'm pretty confident to state, never going to be able to offer as strong a security model as having Bitcoin on the base chain. However, second layer networks are able to do a lot more that you can't do on the base chain. They can also be developed a lot faster because they aren't consensus networks. They, or at least in many cases, they aren't. Side chain can be its own consensus network. They can also scale a lot better and faster and make, trade-offs between centralization and self-sovereignty, and often be able to make breaking changes, without having to get the entire network to update and coordinate. So it's faster iterative development there, and the features that they can offer are only really limited by the creativity of the protocol developers on there. So, this is why I'm generally bullish on seeing a lot more activity where developers are talking about proposals for second layers, and even, certain soft forks to the Bitcoin protocol that would enable easier second layer development, especially if we can ever actually achieve the promise of the permissionless two-way peg. This was actually promised to us a decade ago in the Blockstream sidechain white paper. We were told, two-way pegs are coming, and that has yet to materialize, but I think it's still possible. And if we can actually get to that point, then that will potentially unleash a new wave of innovation where it'll be much easier for people to go off and create their own sidechains and second layers, without having to speculate as to whether or not they'll get, permission or consensus to make changes on the base protocol.
Appreciate that answer. You kind of tackled a few questions and with that answer, so appreciate it. Jeffrey, you asked if we could make a video on how to consolidate UTXOs in the Casa app. Yeah, we can work on that for you. I see that. I just wanted to answer that live. So appreciate you asking that question. And I know we're coming up on time. So the one question I'm interested in, Johan asked, what meme are you loading up for the having?
Oh, well, see, I wasn't sure if that was just a general reference to me talking about narratives and memetics. One of the great things about Bitcoin is that you can create your own memes and narratives. Like this is one way that Bitcoin is self-reinforcing and kind of viral. I think it was Pomp. Back in the day, was the one who coined the phrase like the virus is spreading, and then of course he stopped doing that after the pandemic. But that's because Bitcoin is a kind of mind virus. Like there's a lot of interesting incentive structures around it that of course help it to operate, but there's also of course the incentive to help grow the network, because if you own Bitcoin, then you understand probably Metcalfe's law, network effects, the fact that the value of a network goes up as the total number of participants in the network goes. So we are all incentivized to get more people to participate in the network because theoretically that should make the Bitcoin that we hold worth more. And how do you do that? Well, I think people need to use the skills that they already have. It's been a while since I've had this misconception thrown at me, but at least for a long time in the early days, a lot of people assumed that like the only way that you could contribute to Bitcoin was by being a programmer and by actually writing software. But I would say we're at the point now where pretty much any skill set, at least any like white collar skill set, can contribute, from a career perspective. You can probably find a job where you can work in the industry and contribute. If your skill set is on the communications and marketing side, perhaps your way of contributing is by creating memes. And if some of those memes go viral, it's really hard to quantify what your total contribution is there, but it certainly can't hurt. You make a crappy meme, nobody sees it, no harm, no foul. You make a great meme, who knows, you might become the next Michael Saylor. This is one of the things, I think I actually tweeted just in the past week or two, that one way to earn your quote unquote Bitcoin PhD is to come up with a new way of explaining Bitcoin to a new audience, from a new perspective. And that's one of the things that I think Michael Saylor has done that has made him so great. Not just the fact that he bought a bunch of Bitcoin, it's that he actually came up with a novel way of explaining it from a like corporate treasury perspective. And there are a lot of other people in the space who have done that, and I would say are have earned their honorary Bitcoin PhDs.
Well, thank you, Jameson. Just to respect your time, I think this is a good place to end it. Those were some awesome questions, everyone, and apologies if we weren't able to get to your question. Thank you again, Jameson, for that incredibly informative and insightful presentation. Those were some great visuals, great examples. You really drove home the impact. For those of you interested in taking control of your digital assets like Bitcoin, please be sure to follow Casa on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Instagram. We'll also be sharing a recording of this webinar so you can rewatch it at any time. If you're not yet a Casa member but would like to learn more about our premium self-custody services and inheritance solution, go to casa.io and book a call, and we'll be happy to walk you through any of your options. And this wraps up our deep dive into the 2024 Bitcoin halving. Thank you all for participating, and I hope you have an excellent day.